Vicki.
Welcome, Vicki. You need to call in another.
All right, then we'll call the meeting to order. And we have the treasurer and the secretary of state here, and this is Brad Schimmel, the attorney general. We have our first item of business are the minutes from the June 20th meeting. These are distributed with our packets. I'll make a motion to approve those.
Second it. Doug.
Any discussion? Then all in favor say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Matt.
Aye, Brad. Okay, that's that. And then for this month, we have, or this week, excuse me, for this meeting, we have 11 loans totaling a little over $5 million.
They have been approved for public purpose, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And then we can go ahead and do we have a motion to approve the loans?
Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, I'll make the motion to approve the loans.
I'll second it so we can discuss them.
All right. Any discussion regarding the loans?
Well, just interesting. I now know how much a snowplow costs. $250,000 for a snowplow. Those things are expensive. I never really knew that before. Assuming that's only one snowplow for...
Probably includes the truck.
For a small village. Well, that's what, you know, it is a truck. I knew that, but still a lot of money. Then we have one big loan that's interesting. West Allis borrowing $3 million for some improvement projects. So we don't know what they are, but that's good. Anyway, that's my comments.
Well, actually, Doug, we do know what they are. They gave us a pretty good list.
A big list.
They're capital. But.
And these aren't outside the revenue limits, right?
No.
Okay. I just have one comment. If you look at Bayfield, they're the first five loans. And then I think Doug at one point mentioned a concern about this as well. One of the things that I have a concern with, we keep doing these refinances. And I think maybe it was Rich or somebody mentioned that the way we do that and allow that is we allow them to do that if they take out a different loan or another loan. So they're taking out two smaller loans. But one of the things that concerns me is we're constantly giving out money at the lowest, basically, market rate. So we're always capturing the lowest amount of money because these municipalities, whether it's a city, town, village, or a school district, are constantly just refinancing, which is smart on their part. I get where they're coming from, but... Obviously, if they did a bond, you know, if it's not callable for X number of years or whatever, they're not able to do that. But so if you look at loans 3, 4, and 5, where I think when I asked this question to Jonathan, he said they're only going from 3.75 to 3.5. And obviously, Doug's had some concerns about why voting no on the loans is of general purpose. And this is one of the problems is if the rates are 6% and a year later they drop to 5% and then 2 years later they go to 4%, they're always just going to keep refinancing to go with the lowest rates. And, you know, that's, we are, as trustees for this fund, we are actually representing the school district, trying to make as much money for all the school districts and all the K-12 kids. We're not looking out for we don't have a duty to look out for the city of Bayfield. That is not one of our duties. So I just have a problem with it. Obviously, it's loans we've done in the past, and if you guys want to talk about why we do the refinancing, I think you guys called it their catch or their little something to make it so that they have to do it, but I just still think it's kind of silly.
Well, this is Doug. That raises two questions in my mind. You may were going to respond. This will add to your response. One, A, do we have to let them refinance? And B, can they do it more than once?
Well, I can answer those questions. We don't have to. It's been our policy to allow refinancing. It's been there for how many years?
About 15.
And I would look at it a little differently, Matt.
Can they do it over and over again, or do they?
Yes.
They could do it. Thank you.
I guess I would look at it a little differently. We're getting as much interest rate as the market will bear, basically. I mean, we've just recently lowered our interest rates. The Treasury's at 1.35% earlier this week, or late last week. And so, you know, you could look at it two ways. They're chasing to a lower rate, but we're chasing to get as much as we can, you know, and we're doing better than we obviously could in any other venue.
No, and I get that. My only concern is that we're always capturing the lowest amount because, I mean, this isn't a huge amount, $712,000, but let's say that was $7 million. And they, you know, still, it's not a small amount of money, but if they're constantly chasing the smaller number and we keep giving them a loan, if they did a bond for that, I don't think they'd be able to do that.
How much? The three refinancings are now at 3.5. What were they before?
Like 3.75.
3.75.
I think
so
that's
interesting. It's worth all their effort for a fairly small amount. But anyway.
I think it's a discussion that'd be worth having as to whether or not we would, as a policy, like to do the refinancing or simply to permit refinancing if they could get refinancing from other sources.
If we stop allowing that, and this is a question we don't, the answer is in the air, would that make them more likely not to borrow money from us?
Possibly.
And we, in my opinion, we have a semi-obligation, which Matt and I don't totally agree on, to loan money to schools and municipalities. That was sort of part of, I thought, was our, if not our mandate, our serious interest. So that would be an argument against changing the policy because we want to be helpful to these
Governments. The only point I'd say to that, Doug, is obviously interest rates were higher, you know, was it 6, 7, 8 years ago. And one of my concerns is, and when we had the massive prepayments, that because we have no prepayment penalty, I think it was $500 million in a year and a half was prepaid. I guess my question is, if they had taken these out in the bigger amounts, any of these $60,000, $50,000, they probably wouldn't matter as much. They could probably refinance at a bank or whatever. But when we're giving, like I know we gave Verona $20 million or something like that, when we give these big chunks out, if they had done a bond, I mean, what's the earliest you think they could renegotiate or call it or whatever? You know, like, for example, one of the things when we did the discussion, I came separately and talked about the Bucks bill. One of the reasons you guys said that we were advantageous to them is that we weren't going to put a parameter on them because the other bonds they have couldn't be called for 10, 15 years, whereas we could be. So obviously other bonds that these people might get would have a higher rate on them.
But these cities never buy bonds from us.
Not from us. We don't do bonds. But they could get it on the private market.
Tom, are you asking on the front end when they first borrow?
Mm-hmm.
You can have a call provision at any point in time. And so it depends on how much that call provision means to that particular community that's borrowing. In some cases where they have ideas of refinancing quickly, they will have a very short period under which it can't be called. And some of them might go as long as 10 years or more. And so the reason why that policy came about is if you go back 15 years ago, neither Rich nor I nor Jonathan were sitting in our respective seats. And so what happened when interest rates dropped is that was the portfolio lost a lot of the funds at that point. And so that money moved from loans into cash. And so the earnings of the funds dropped precipitously. But now that we have done more in terms of other investments, we went to being able to move those loans that were being prepaid into municipal bonds, it allowed us to keep earning, even though we are losing a significant point. So it brings us back to your point that the policy can be changed. If the board wants to say, fine, we'll do the loans, but we won't refinance our own loans.
And I understand we're not doing that today because nobody talked about that, but I just, when you look at it, I mean, the rates, you know, it's what they either go up or down, typically one way or the other, and they've been going down to the point of nothing right now. But my whole point is we're giving out money typically at the lowest amount, whereas if we had captured it at the higher amount, I much prefer instead of the loans to just doing the actual municipal bonds because that we can sell more easily, as well as the fact that the bond, the parameters are set up. Ours are the prepay, no prepayment, all that stuff. So we're a really good deal in a lot of ways, so. It just, that's one of, and, you know, to your point, right now I think we have about $450 million in loans to municipalities, trust funds.
Just shy of,
let's say it's $500 million, right? $500 million. Right now, every single one of those people could pay us off this year, and we would have $500 million in cash earning nothing.
There's really two reasons, Matt, for that.
But that's a problem. That's a problem.
You know, the first one is it's a marketing tool for us. It gives us a competitive advantage against other lenders to allow that flexibility to the borrowers in the future. And because of that, we can get a higher interest rate going in the beginning.
So
and the second reason is because it maintains the portfolio income. If we didn't allow people to refinance, they would just go to the bond market or some other lender to refinance us totally out of the deal. When we're still making loans at that specific interest rate to a new customer, why wouldn't we make it to an existing customer?
I get that. That was about the point I was going to make, and to counter Matt's concern, is that if we didn't allow it, A, we might not get the loan, but we already talked about that. But secondly, as you just pointed out, if the interest rates went down, they would get the money somewhere else, and we would suddenly have cash, maybe a lot of cash, which then you would have to try to find some quick municipal bonds or something, and you might be able to get a bunch of them at good interest rates, but maybe not. So I think the policy probably is beneficial to both us and to the municipalities.
We might be able to tweak it a little bit, and we're taking a look at some language to do that in the future, and we'll bring it up at a future meeting.
That last point on it, then we move on. It's just that goes to my whole general problem with the loan portfolio, because you know Doug and I disagreed on whether it's our duty to do that. Obviously, it's not legally our duty, but it's something that they have done for 71 or whatever. But my concern would be, I prefer the bonds that you guys are buying. I prefer those because I know you guys say we're by being an originator and so forth, we have these advantages, but this. Our bond portfolio is going to be called immediately tomorrow, whereas this stuff usually could be. And that's a problem. That all of it could be wiped out. And obviously $500 million was when the rates ticked down. I mean, we went from $700 million to $200
million. I'd like to call the question. Just to get us going.
Move on.
So all in favor of approving the loan, say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Doug.
No, Matt.
Okay. If we don't have any old business, we can move right into item number 4 on here. And we have some help here from the University of Wisconsin to help us examine some of our investment policy strategies. And thank you very much, gentlemen, for all your work on this.
Very kind of you.
They were very helpful. I can say that.
Should we turn this? Who's going to lead on this?
I think Lee Bridgeford will just give a little parameter. Both Mark Reddy and Brian Helmer were very, very helpful to us, and especially as it came to addressing the asset allocation model, which we'll get into a kind of a discussion here. I'd like to give an awful lot of credit to Rich for doing the multiple drafts that we then pour all of us, I've poured over. So I'm going to have to ask Rich to walk through much of this. Just before you all walked in, I mean, there are three major reasons that there's really a fourth. The first reason is that the legislature gave us what's called prudent investment authority last August, and that authority is something that we'd like to take advantage of and utilize in a careful and prudent manner. And to do that, first thing first, you have to have an investment policy because you have to measure your prudence, if you will, against your activities. Secondly, if we wanted to have an outside fund manager handling any portion of this at some point, including a public manager like SWIB, we would need an investment policy to guide them. And then thirdly, for ourselves, what we really want to do here is to create the opportunity to earn capital gains. We just talked about this before. To do that, we also want to reduce risk by the creation of a smoothing fund. And then thirdly, put more of our dollars to work. Right now we have fair amount of money, and typically have a fair amount of money, $150 million is pretty much the average, that is not actively working in loans, but it's working in, you know, in money markets, cash. So we have everything at work, but it's the rate of interest. So that's the reason for this, and that's why we'd like to get your approval. But we're not asking for your approval today. I think we need to take a little time to go through this today. Give it a little time for you guys to submit some questions or have us follow your direction on alterations. And then perhaps within a month, perhaps we can get to the point of adopting this. So with that, I turn it over to Rich.
Thanks, Jonathan. Now, like Jonathan was saying, that we need to adopt a new investment policy to guide future investment decision-making, because we have a lot more choices now with the prudent investor standard that was provided us last August. The board previously did not have a formal investment policy because the legislature limited our investment choices that were available for the board. Removal of these constraints allows DCPL Asset Management to now follow industry best practices, which starts with this policy. This policy is meant to provide a guide for all future investments and ensure long-term prudence and care by not just us, but future boards and agency staff. When this project first started, we went to SWIB and talked to them about some advice about developing such policy. And they came up with ranges of $250,000 to $1 million to have consultants develop this policy for us. And we thought that that was a little bit high for us. And so what I did is I went to the Western States Land Commissioners Association conference, and I talked to a state that had been going through the same thing. They had a strict policy regarding their investments, and then they were moving to the Prudent Investor Authority. And so what I was able to do is utilize their framework as a guide for starting this. And with Tom and Jonathan and Mark and Brian, I believe that we have developed a strong policy and an asset allocation model that should help guide the agency for many years. Now, there's really three takeaways, I think, from that helped guide this policy. One, our beneficiaries rely on a significant, stable, and sustainable income distribution every year as the sole source of their funding. Two, there's constitutional language that prevents the distribution of fund principal, and so the investment needs to generate all of the income, sufficient distributable income each and every year. And three, the growth in the common school fund from unclaimed property and peace fines and forfeitures has been reduced to a level that is below long-term inflation expectations. So if we want to maintain future purchasing power for generations to come, we need to do something about that to generate capital gains to add to the principal to supplement those other additions. And taken together, these facts require that changes need to be made to the asset allocation to generate some capital gains. The current distribution policy, the risk objectives of this agency and the interest rate environment all dictate that these changes are made very gradually. One of those things in regards to the risk objectives is to develop a smoothing fund to balance any additional risk that might come from allocating funds to equities and other investments. The smoothing fund would be used to supplement the investment income to fund the distribution to schools in years that the investment results were poor. You've had a chance to review the policy. Did you have any questions as you were going through before we move on to asset allocation?
Could I ask you to make one clear thing?
Sure.
We talked about it briefly. We picked a number, 3.5%, but that's not a hard and fast number, but that's what we figured is presently the expectation of the K-12 school libraries. And so we picked that number, and why don't you explain how the smoothing fund would work with that
sure.
number?
Yeah,
that number is not locked in. We hope to be earning more than that.
I was about to say, I don't understand this smoothie fund thing, but just
okay. So what the smoothing fund would do is we would create a pot of money separate from both fund principal and the distribution to supplement...
Where would that pot come from?
Current earnings. And so what we would do is we would withhold basically a bit of the current distribution into a separate fund to allow us to fund distributions in the future in years when income was lower.
It would be so categorized.
For example, instead of giving them $35 million this year, we might have given them $30 and put $5 million into this fund.
That's right.
Okay, I now understand that. What would we do with this fund? Invest it in the
We would invest
way?
It just like we would all the other
ones. Yeah, so we school loans, municipal
right.
bonds, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it doesn't change anything except it gives us a second pool of money, which we'd have available.
Yeah, it would reduce the risk of future distributions being lower because of investment returns in that year.
But if in a future year there was a problem, a need, we would take some of that money and give it to them that year.
Right.
But that money is going to be invested, so it won't be liquid.
Well, we're going to take that into we'll take the liquidity into consideration when we're moving forward with this. Yeah.
So if we saw a potential problem on the horizon, we might not invest some of that smooth fund. We might keep it in cash.
Just as we do now, Doug,
correct.
We know we have a distribution coming up. We maintain liquidity in anticipation of that.
Okay, I got it.
Leading up to it.
I don't quite see why we can't just maintain that liquidity in the big fund. And we got 100 and some million or now. If things were getting strange,
well, let me
we make sure we maintain that.
The Constitution requires us to distribute 100% of our earnings every year. In some years, we've not distributed all the money because it's come in late, and we're exceeding our estimate. Tom, you can correct me on this or add to it. But the smoothing fund, if once it's created, would enable us to maintain stable
funding. But that fund would have the same fund. Legal requirement to be distributed.
And what you'd actually call the smoothing fund is deferred distributions. That's the way I characterize it.
Does the law allow that?
Yes, and we have done it in the past, but not at a large amount of money. Now, we will have
so
to
again,
have
if the law says we must distribute all of our earnings, how do we get around that law?
Because this money would be in a pot to be distributed.
Does the law say we can hold it and give it later?
Go ahead, Tom.
We just kind of do that.
We're going to have an agreement with
the Constitution requires us to distribute the income from the fund. It doesn't necessarily require us to do it every year, and because of the fact that we distribute the common school fund money mid-year, we are always rolling over a little bit because of the fact that we own a bunch of Wisconsin bonds. They pay interest on May 1. As you know, we make that distribution to DPI and to the school districts in April. And so everything that we earn from that point on is going to be rolling over into here.
So we sort of interpret the Constitution and says that we must distribute it, but it doesn't say in a timely manner. It lets us decide when. I got it. Thank you.
And it kind of formalized, you know, we could do that with our current pot of cash, but it kind of formalizes it to restrict future boards and so on, so that our beneficiaries know that in the future they're going to have that money available if income results are lower for that 1 year. And the 3.5% was kind of where we are today. You know, we have about $1 billion in the common school fund, and we distributed a little bit over $37 million this year. And so 3.5% is in the ballpark of where we are today. But the way that this thing is set up is that number becomes irrelevant over time, because once we have the smoothing fund fully developed, it becomes the distribution doesn't become 3.5%. It becomes the average of the last 5 years' distributions. And because the amount of the fund will be increasing over time through these additions, that will grow.
It might be helpful, Rich. I think, is it your assumption that the fund will generally do better than the 3.5%, and that's where the funding of the smoothing fund comes from?
Yes,
the 3.5% is kind of the floor.
What are we setting as our benchmark? Because 3.5% would be 3.5% as a benchmark on a $1 billion fund.
Right.
What is our benchmark going to be about?
You mean for the whole fund? It depends on what we're invested in. It's not a strict number like that. It is relative to the tax.
85% of the loan.
85% of it would be the taxable municipal bond market.
Which is right around the 3.5, probably?
Right now it is. Very close to that.
I mean, one of the things that I've had, and so this is confidential draft 2.8. Does that mean there's been 8 of them, or what does that mean?
Yeah, it's been a lot of them.
Okay. Well, I mean, first, I would have preferred to have seen some previously. I've asked one, but I haven't gotten them, but that's fine. One of the things that I have some concerns with is...
What page are you on? So we just kind of
I'm not on a specific page. I'm just reading the 2.8.
Yeah.
No, but, like, if I look at this, basically the takeaway from this is 85% is going to stay basically as is, loans and bonds, and then 15% is going to get freed up. So you use even money, that's $150 million is going to be freed up for stocks, equity, which you guys called for in our investment strategy. Well, there's a couple of problems. I understand the smoothing fund. I understand the concept of it. We need it in order to make it, because obviously every year we can't give out. Because some years will be higher, some years will be lower. But even year one, we could have a problem, because if it happens to be like 08, which obviously is a catastrophic year, they lost 40% of the market. So if the three of us authorize $150 million to go into the stock market and it loses 40%, we just lost $60 million. So we don't have a smoothing fund. We're already 2 years behind. So, I mean, it is a problem getting in, because if you do have two bad years initially, there's no smoothing fund. There's nothing there.
You put your finger on exactly the
reason. It is a problem.
Well, you put your finger on exactly why we wouldn't go right to 15%. We would be moving slowly into this.
But even if we made our normal $35 million and we lost, if we lost $35 million, we'd have zero. So the liabilities would be zero. But I guess one of the things that I would like to see, that I've talked and I've met with SWIB, and you and I went over there, Jonathan, one of the things that's not in here is any discussion about using SWIB as a partnership. This is all basically starts as an asset allocation, and then from there we're going to have to figure out our money managers, if it's private or SWIB. But one of the things that I talked about, and I had a good conversation with Jonathan, I went over there, and I don't know if the gentleman from UW were privy to this, but basically they at the UW, or excuse me, at the SWIB, they're going to have some sort of mechanism soon where they're going to be able to segment. Right now they have the Wisconsin Retirement System, which your retirement, your retirement, my retirement, everybody's retirement then. It's a $100 billion fund. We could, in theory, add our money to them at some point. So let's say it was $99 billion, not exactly, and we added our $1 billion. We'd be one percentage of SWIFT. They would be able to keep it in the same fund, but segment us differently so that whatever they make percentage-wise, we could make. So when SWIB makes 7%, we make 7%. And obviously SWIB is well-known, respected, universal, and they're already diversified funds. So we wouldn't have to worry about the asset allocation. The core fund is half equities, and then it goes on down from there, but it's a very diverse, you know, diversified fund. So that would be, I think, a great way to go.
So what you're saying is we would give them this 15% and let them do it.
And going up higher than that at some point. I mean, at that point, it might be not us as a four-person body. Maybe it's the next group of people.
Well, this is a recommendation.
Yeah.
You're saying we could decide to go to 25 if we want.
Exactly. And one of the problems that I have with this, and then I'll ask the gentleman from the UW school, is in your guys' thing that you prepared for us, let's look at, if you look at the Common School Fund, you guys talk about how what the average university does. You know, you did the top 75 with $50 billion to $100 billion, and most of them are at least about half in equities. So we are at a, that's on page 28.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at where they're at, on the average university that you guys use as a comparison, they're only at 9% fixed income. We're at 85. And so we're not going to be able to capture that money like everybody else is. Not something we're authorizing today, obviously, but
those endowments all have the ability to reach into principal in a bad year.
Mm-hmm.
We're constitutionally prescribed to do that. That's a challenge.
No, and I get that one challenge, but part of the things that you all said is that we have to have a stable income, and I've had a conversation with Jonathan about this. That's because we fund right now, it's earmarked to the money gets earmarked right now to the library. The legislature just did that 20, 30 years ago. It hasn't always been that way. I don't know.
All right.
I don't know.
5 years ago, was it, Tom?
I thought it was much longer, but I've never followed.
I think you and I looked at the statutes once, but I mean, we.
So you're saying it's only by legislation that we give it to the library.
Exactly. It has to go to the school. It has to go to the school. K-12 schools. It can't go anywhere else.
And that happened when? 28 years ago?
We'll get the actual.
We don't know the date.
But I think that there's actual language in the Constitution that talks about the library.
It does mention library supplies in the Constitution.
It does in the Constitution.
Yes, it does.
Well, when I've talked to people.
Let me finish.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, sort of, but on point. So I would assume then, unless Tom finds out differently as our lawyer, that we've always given it to the school library. There wasn't a change of policy at a certain point.
We've always given it to the school, including the library. So I think it's relatively more recent that the legislature decided that the school library should be the teacher.
Benefactor.
Again, and as a result, it really strengthened us in some ways because now you got all these librarians really interested in that money coming.
The Constitution mentions the library, so why did they have to make
Well, I'll get the constitutional language.
No, don't.
Oh, it's right here, right?
It talks about the money going to the operation and maintenance of the common schools and libraries and apparatus, therefore. So libraries are mentioned in the Constitution, but it's not limited to libraries in the Constitution.
I guess like the way I would clear it up is if we gave it to every school district, so Madison gets some, Verona gets some, Milwaukee gets some, Wauwatosa gets some, they obviously have school libraries, so it would fund them one way or another, it would go there. But if you look at, so basically, we, as a part of the, if you, I put that in front of you, gentlemen, is that's how the last budget was done, it was Act 55. They earmarked categorical aids from us at like $36 million and $38 million. But if you look at the bottom number circled, the total amount we give to schools through general and categorical aid is a little over $5 billion a year. So we're a drop in the bucket. So my whole point, and I had this conversation with Jonathan once, I said if it wasn't, and I understand librarians want to have a dedicated stream of, they want to have money coming to them, and obviously the legislature would have to make them whole, but when it goes, when you mentioned the word stable, that's our problem. If in 1 year we made 0% and the next year we made 15% because the stock market goes up and down, that's still a rate of return of $150 million over 2 years. That's better than 3.5%, which is $70 million. So my goal, and the way I look at it as a fiduciary, really the three constitutional guys here, is we have to make as much money as possible in a prudent, safe fashion. I don't think anyone's going to say SWIB doesn't do prudent and safe. They do it. That's how they manage their money. And they manage $100 billion, your retirement, my retirement, everybody's retirement.
100 million?
100 billion.
Billion.
They're 100 times less.
I thought you misspoke.
Yeah, I might have.
It is billion.
Yeah, they're 100 times. They're 100 times less. And they're already a diversified fund. I mean, that's the whole
thing.
We
said it before. We do 1% of that, yep. And we get the share. What I don't know, and you do, and I suspect your research, is over the last, let's say, 20 years, what have they earned each year about?
Their average, and I think it's in a packet I could give you, but it's 7.4% for 20 years.
Have they ever been below 3%?
They've been well below it. One year they lost 25%. So that's the same problem in the $150 million we're going to have. If you, any time you put money in the stock market, you have an opportunity to make zero or less. You could lose money.
So SWIB has had a bad year in 10 years.
They, back in 08, which was a bad, really bad economy, I'm sure you saw it in your retirement, SWIB lost 25% on the core fund. But they've since made it up, obviously, because the next year they made it.
Last 1 year today.
And overall, over 20 years, SWIB made 7.4%. That's their average.
So giving them our 15 or more percent of our investable money would be a pretty safe thing over the long term. There might be occasional disasters, and those disasters maybe could be made up by the smoothing fund, but maybe not, depending on when they happen.
How long they happen.
Yeah, I mean, how soon they happen, and so forth.
Okay. Oh, and I think you could also move right to a higher percentage. Like you said, 15 is the starting point. It could be 25. I mean, I guess I'd ask the gentleman from the UW school here is, what the big endowments in this, $1 billion range, I mean, what would you say, are their equities, are they close to 50% on average, or?
I think that's probably fair. I mean, but I think the point is, and you suggested a way around it, the challenge that we were presented with is to create an asset allocation that moves in the right direction, but recognizes and respects the constraints on losing money that the librarian, suddenly there's no money and it's a big crisis for everybody. So,
and they're not allowed to dip into principal.
And they're not allowed to dip into principal.
That's the key.
Right.
If you said design an asset allocation for a foundation that's allowed to operate the way other foundations operate, then you'd probably get an asset allocation that looks like other foundations.
Well, yeah, I agree.
Well, I guess to the point that you guys can get this.
With one caveat, which is that you have this odd feature of the way that you securitize loans that gives you an unusual extra return to the loans that you make relative to the risk that no one else can repeat. I mean, SWIB would love, if SWIB had access to that pool, they would say, great, give us $50 billion of those.
Yeah.
So could we sell our money?
No,
I've never got the impression.
I don't know that you can sell.
We can. But I've never got the impression that anybody else would want ours because of the fact that we allow no prepayment.
Well, that reduces the value, but the fact is that for essentially treasury-type risk, you're getting treasury.
You're getting 2.5 points of
overhead. Yeah, so take some of the 2.5 out. That's a fair point, but not all of it.
So we could
call
you're saying we could.
Worth 2.5%.
So we could sell, and I know Rich and I had a good conversation about this.
We could sell them. The problem is that we would be selling assets that we're earning an extraordinary return on, and we don't need the cash.
Well, when you say an extraordinary return, that's comparison to the market of treasuries and so forth, not compared to the other asset allocation.
Compared to our fixed income allocation.
Our other fixed income,
Or other fixed income.
Well, I guess one of the big holdups.
Let me clarify Mark's point. The point you made was that if the schools and municipalities cannot, I can't believe the word for it, cannot pay us back. Mm-hmm. Because we'd take them, and that's what you say people would like to have.
Well, we can intercept their state aid.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so you have essentially an extra, you have the ability to garnish their wages.
Right.
No mail tax. Right?
What are you saying? So
that only applies to that segment of our loans, yeah. Which is about 30% at the moment.
Yeah, so the point is that's valuable investment that's available through the features of the state law that's not available to most investors. And so you would, to the extent that you can reap all of the value from that and sell them off, then that's a fair point. I don't know to what degree you really can.
Well, we can, but to your point, Mark, I agree with you. If we take the lowest, so this would basically take the municipalities with the lowest, you know, B, whatever you call them, I don't know, triple B or whatever, or lower, that's who we want to lend to, because we're actually getting the best availability, because we...
Well, but you lend it all at the same rate. So I think you want to lend it.
But I'm saying we're getting a product. We're being able to sell it. I mean, like if we gave it, yeah. I'm assuming Madison's AAA or whatever, it's not as good of a deal for us, and that's why they don't borrow from us, and they also have a bond rate. But
it would be a good deal for you if they borrowed from you, but your point is you're right, they don't.
Well, one of the things that I guess it's kind of the holdup, and you, in the document that you all provided, it mentioned multiple times that we have to give stable money. In a lot of ways, I feel that that's something that is true, has been true, but it is something that could be changed. If we only give $36 million out of a $5.4 billion budget purely to the UW, it would not be hard for the legislature to just make that library portion whole, as long as we kept giving the money to the schools. Because we're going to give them at least that. We're going to get 3.5% as an average for sure. But more likely, we can get 5, 6, 7.
Well, so I would say that, so the UW Foundation spending policy it's a little south of 4.5% is what they spend out of. So they do it over like a rolling average of the last 3 years of fund value.
Well, therefore,
so you're not going to get up to, you're not going to get to 7.
No, I'm saying, but we would be making that. What does that fund make, the one that's got $3 billion? Is it closer to 6 or 7?
Well, up and down.
I don't think so. I think on average it's closer to 5.5, and I think one of the challenges there is that they're in the fundraising business.
Sure.
And one of the things you don't want to do in the fundraising business is give potential donors a reason to get scared. So you manage it pretty conservatively, right? I mean, that's just the nature of that kind of a fund. I think the main point is, if there was an ability to either spend principal or if there was an ability to smooth out a bad year because of extra volatility, because of trying to seek more return, that would change a lot of things. That would change the way you'd compute this.
And that's the point I'm making, is we could change that. We could make, if we're only giving $36 million out of a $5-plus billion budget, if that was changed so that any money we gave was just money on top, we would basically be rewriting the asset allocation model. How it was done was basically saying we have to give the library aid $35 million a year. If that was taken and the legislature just said, okay, we'll cover the 35, because you're going to make on average 35 elsewise, because we can't give it anywhere else but schools, that would change it. And as Jonathan and I had a conversation, it's a problem because the librarians do depend on it. They have to have stable resources. They can't say, okay, this year we get zero, next year you give us $70 million. They need to know for budgetary purposes. But 1 year making zero and the next year making $90 million doesn't matter at all on a $5.4 billion budget. I mean, it's just a drop in the bucket.
You can anticipate the concern in anything controlled by the legislature has volatility.
Exactly.
The libraries don't trust DPI.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really, if you find that the politics of this, that they really like having this discrete flow of funds from us.
They don't trust DPI?
Well, they don't trust DPI not to cut the libraries when they're being cut on their overall budget.
Yeah.
You know, DPI wouldn't do something mean, but they might do something
they don't trust DPI to implement legislative action in a way that would protect them. I mean, it's the legislature, bottom line, that decides to cut DPI's budget. And what you're saying is that they don't trust the legislature. DPI is just the conduit.
Correct.
One more question for the two gentlemen from UW, and I appreciate your time. But if we didn't have that restraint, like you said, it changes everything. So I guess that would be one thing that I would like to at least see if we could even consider it, because I said this to Jonathan once. I said, if we can make more money, a 5-6, you know, more like SWIB 7.4%, that's a better deal because it's just making more money. And I don't, if we would be able to have the ability to utilize SWIB under the segmenting thing, which the gentleman, David Villa?
Yeah.
He mentioned something they thought they should have in about a year. He even used the comment he'd like to invest more money, which he could bring as much as he could in. They want as much money as they can invest, they want to invest. So from a gentleman, from the perspective of the three commissioners here, it's going to be dicey for us to lend out money and then, you know, have to bring in managers of the team here to do it, because there's going to be losses.
It's dicey just from lend money or invest money, which is you mean.
I'm saying it's dicey because there will be years. We can't anticipate if this year is going to be a good year or not. I mean, if obviously you could be the best investor in the world, but there will be up years and down years. And SWIB has that. Every money market, every big company does. I'm sure if you guys work with that. But I feel comforted knowing, I mean, they're literally next door to us. They must have a couple hundred people working there. And they obviously do really good work, and they're managing a ton of money. Nobody I've ever talked to, Republican, Democrat, Independent, ever has had a problem with the way they manage money. Every once in a while, their salaries get noticed, but they do good work. And if you do good work, you make good money. So it's just something that we could consider. I don't know how soon they'll have that segmenting, but you guys, I mean, do you hear good things about SWIB, I assume?
Full disclosure, I just agreed at the end of July to move over to SWIB. So I'm here last
year. You're not going to say anything.
I recuse myself from talking about SWIB. Obviously, they are very well respected within the industry.
So I guess my point is we are a government agency. They are a government agency of sorts. I don't know. I don't like the idea of reinventing the wheel is my point. We have to keep whatever portion is going to be done for the trust fund loans, and that's for the commission side of it. Is it half? Is it 80%?
In order to save time, if you don't mind,
go ahead.
You've been pushing SWIB as an idea for months, so we don't need to hear a lot more about that.
Yeah.
We understand that. So what you're saying basically is once we proceed with this process, we have two choices. We give SWIB some money,
SWIB.
15 or X percent, or we have him go to the stock market and start buying stock. Those are our two choices. And you're saying that it would be easier and maybe safer to let SWIB invest X dollars than to have our staff begin to start playing the stock market, if you will.
Well,
that's the point.
Well, there's other options.
Well, let me answer that. That's exactly
here.
What I'm saying, but
okay,
I'd even go a step further than that because we are the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, and let's face it, we have a little bit of land. We have 70,000 acres. That's a separate issue. It's in a separate fund. The Common School Fund is basically cash, a little bit of land, but let's say, for argument's sake, cash. There is nothing to stop us from taking the full amount. Now, obviously, you'd have to figure out how much you want to get a trust fund loan, but one of the things we had a conversation earlier, you said, you know, you thought it was our legal responsibility. Most of these loans can be got by these municipalities without us. The reason we have to have our rates at whatever percentage we do is to remain competitive. But we don't have to do these loans. I prefer to see the ones that are really difficult ones where they can't get the money from anywhere else because then we're capturing that advantage of where they can't go out there. But we could easily set it even higher than SWIB. SWIB is already diverse. They're not just stock market. We could give half of our fund to them. We could give 40%, 60%. So there's also no reason to believe we couldn't just give them our entire cash fund. And they would literally manage it exactly how they manage theirs in a diverse manner. And they have gotten 7.4%, whereas over the last 20 years, we're about 4.5%. So that's on $1 billion.
And again, if we did that, then we'd have to tell the schools no more loan.
Well, first and foremost, most of our loans, you look, they mostly go to municipalities.
Yeah, I use that word.
Well, but and again, you know.
The answer to the question is yes.
Or bring it down a notch, maybe not do half. I mean, as they've said, our loan portfolio has been shrinking. It goes up, it ebbs and flows, but maybe you say we keep $200 million, $300 million. I don't know where you keep it for the loan portfolio.
You say give all, so now you're kind of backing off. Maybe.
Well, I would, but you gentlemen probably wouldn't.
Maybe 80%.
Yeah.
Let me ask this question of our staff. Is there any way we can determine whether these people who are borrowing money are in a situation where they can't get it somewhere else? Yeah, I wouldn't object as much to your policy philosophy if we had some way of saying and how much money we would need to save just to handle those problem people. I mean, if a school can't get a new furnace and the kids are going to freeze because the bank won't loan them the money, then we ought to be able to help those people. And I don't know what the numbers are.
I don't think it's about help. But with all due respect, I don't think it's about our responsibility to help these municipalities. This is good business. We're making a decent return loaning money to local governments with almost no freaking risk.
No, we're not. We can make twice as much doing
that's
this.
Bullshit. I'm sorry, but that's just baloney. You can't get that every year. We've got this absolute restriction on, excuse my language, I forgot about this.
It's okay.
should have got confidential.
You know, no, we didn't. Delete. So, this just is not the way it works in this world. We've got an opportunity to provide a service to local governments, yes,
but we're making a loan to them that is very competitive in the market and is much more than we can invest the money in any kind of risk instrument that is less risky. So we've got this opportunity here. I think this document, Matt, is going to be necessary whether we go to SWIB or not. And this is like a precursor. The board will decide whether we're going to lay off some money on SWIB and how much. And I think that there's a good argument to be made to ask SWIB to segment some of our funds and invest it for us based on the policies that we've adopted at the board.
Well, to cool it off, Doug brought up actually a good point that I actually would wonder.
I'm Irish.
Of our loans, of the $450 million, what percentage of them do they need us for it? Because if they do, that's actually, we kind of have them in a good spot because the three of us here are fiduciaries with this fund. We do not have a fiduciary duty to give savings to the city of Bayfield, the city of Milwaukee. That is not our duty. Our duty is to make as much money as possible for our beneficiaries. So
right.
All the money we lend out, could they, which percentage of that, 10, 20, 30%, could they not get anywhere else? Because I've been told that we keep our rates so full where they're at, we have to be competitive. So obviously they could get these loans elsewhere. Could they not get these loans anywhere else?
In some cases, the answer is yes. And it's been situational. You can't say that on an average year it's X amount because it really does depend on what's going on. There have been communities that found themselves in a pinch because of something that went on unique to that community. There were five school districts that got in some deep stuff because of some other investments they made. And so their ability to borrow in the market was compromised. And so when you ask what that number is, it's hard to say in any given year. When we're talking about a tough year like 2008, 2009, that number is much bigger because of the fact that the bond market wasn't working at all. And so during that year, we loaned out close to $240 million.
I forgot that we had a big upsurge of loans.
Right.
We
were the only business in town.
The state treasurer is bringing up some good points. However, we developed this in accordance with the law as it exists, mm-hmm. not the law as someone might hope it would be. And if you're now talking about changing the law, that is a very different situation.
Well, changing the law or changing the Constitution?
Well, no, he's referring to the law in regards of how the money gets segmented from the law, that how we give it out. But we could make zero next year, and it's not be illegal. Obviously, it would be bad, and they don't want that. But there's nothing preventing us from making zero. I'm not saying that that's what we advocate, but
I think you might get upset with us if we made.
Well, no, but I'm saying right now we could, as with prudent investment that we were given under the Bucks bill, we could start adopting a policy where we would be years where we make nothing or very little. It wouldn't be illegal. To your point, we want to make sure that the library aids were funded to their current levels because obviously they don't want to be cut down to zero. Good point.
If we make zero, I'm not going to the lunch.
That wouldn't be a very good check to present. But,
so it seems to me that there are two levels of this meeting. One, to see if we sort of, I guess, kind of like this idea. And then B, if we were to like this idea, at a future point, we'd have to deal with what Matt is talking about mostly, and that is what to do with how much of our money.
Right.
What to do with it and how much of it.
That's exactly right.
That discussion is not for today.
Sure.
So for timely, I'd like to suggest we put that on hold so I can get where I need to go pretty soon.
Oh, you're right, Doug. This policy doesn't talk about where
I understand.
We choose an asset manager or which asset manager we might choose.
Nor the proportion of the asset allocation model you move into initially.
This is just some rough thinking here.
Yeah, it starts at 15%.
It starts at no more than 15%. Mm-hmm. And the board would make the decision as to how fast we proceeded into that asset allocation model.
I understand that. Well,
yeah, I read the thing back. I mean, I get everything you guys do, and you're right, under current law, that's what you worked off. I just...
So what do we need to do? We need to say, this is a good document, and we sort of accept it as our policy, or what are we supposed to do next? What motion needs to be made, or what activity?
No motion to that.
We're not going to do that today. We're going to all have a chance to go back and probably in a month come back and have further discussion.
So today what we need mostly is a thorough understanding of this from these five gentlemen,
and
particularly the two folks that
two guys
cannot be here all the time. So I guess I would ask, Mr. Chairman, that we ask both of them to spend 5 minutes each or whatever to tell us what they think about all this so we know how to proceed ourselves.
I agree with that, but one last comment when obviously Jonathan got a little upset over there about the 20-year look back. I guess I'd say is the 20-year look back is fact. It's not that they don't make 7.4 every year, but that's what they average.
Their 10-year average is 5.3 right now.
But I'm saying, you know, we're looking long-term. It's a long-term fund. I mean, they are going to be close to the market. The core fund and the variable fund are
I agree with you.
Very close to 7.4 free. My point being, that is attainable. And I know big money investment people, I guarantee you, I've put the top five investment people on something before, I guarantee you they're not telling their prospectus that they're shooting for 2, 3%. They're looking to get to 7%. And obviously you can't guarantee it, but we do know SWIB made it. If the last 20 years were different, Doug, I wasn't here, I've only been a year and a half, same with they're here, and the law didn't allow it, so it's not like it's anyone's fault, but my question would be, we would be in a much better position today, long term, if it had made more money. So.
Right, and it all gets down to what's, I mean, we all know in this room, particularly the three of us that are elected people, that return also depends on what in the hell happens in the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what just went on with England and Europe, and what's going to happen in other places. So, I mean, I'm not a big believer in the viability of the stock market. I think it could really go to hell in the next few years because of the world situation, because of climate change, which is going to have a major impact on the fossil fuel industry. So I'm much less savvy than you to the possible security of the stock of
sure.
investment. We'll quit now. Go ahead.
Right, good, good.
Mr. Chairman.
Please, Brian or Mike, do you have
a So, you know, Doug asked for me to try to characterize how I think about this document. And so let me try to do a couple things. Under the constraints that we were given, which reflected a strong desire to put a fund in place that didn't have a lot of volatility on a year-to-year basis, but took advantage of some of the new opportunities that the legislature provided, you know, the decisions that we were trying to address had to do with the trade-off between getting more aggressive with investments in equities and introducing some volatility, introducing the risk of a bad year with at least a portion of the portfolio, with the concerns about disappointing the librarians across the state. And in my view, I'll just speak for myself, what came out of it in this document is a reflection of the fact that while the returns are low for the loan portfolio, the relationship between that return and the risk is still very favorable, but it's low return. And it's steady, solid money with very little risk. People would really actually want that as part of their portfolio. Whether it would be all of your portfolio would depend on your overall ability to handle down years, and that's Matt's point in the long run. But in the short run, having an opportunity to address the other primary concern that was raised by the staff, which is this concern that the fees, fines, forfeitures, and unclaimed property was not growing and was not allowing, as it traditionally had, the fund principal to keep up with inflation, which puts us in another tough situation in terms of the overall return. We tried to find a mechanism to retain a lot of smooth stability of return generation, to take full advantage of the risk-return opportunity that the loans provide, move towards a higher return-generating asset that introduces some, but hopefully limited volatility under the current rules as we understood them. And then I thought the smoothing fund mechanism was a clever, and I give the staff credit for coming up with that idea, was a clever mechanism that allowed us to potentially pick a number as a starting point, 3.5%, that feels probably somewhat palatable to the librarians as a starting point, that you're going to be guaranteed 3.5% now. And one of the questions I had is, if the fund return is below 3.5%, what happens? Then they don't get 3.5%.
Right.
So without the smoothing fund
right.
in place.
Before the smoothing fund.
So there's a little
risk. Before this movement gets big enough.
Right.
To
be
able to make up.
The first few years could be catastrophic.
That's right.
So if we invest and we happen to pick
right.
the next 2 years are bad,
So without changing the librarian's expectations, a lot of the risk of moving in this direction comes in those early years. But the truth is that risk was always there anyway. So we're just calling attention to it. But the cleverness of it is you build that smoothing fund by earning slightly more than the 3.5 that you put out there as your target. You get that up in place, and once that's in place, two good things happen. One, you feel better about it taking increasingly more risk because you know you have your backstop. And two, the librarians are going to feel good about the fact that once the smoothing fund is full, if the earnings are above the 3.5, they get the benefit of that because the smoothing fund is full and that's just going to be paid out under the current rules. So in the long...
But if things are good and we make more than 3.5, we're not going to give them the smoothing fund. We won't give that to them.
So if the smoothing fund is full, which is one year of payments.
35 million-ish.
Call it 35 million.
I guess I never heard that before today.
We hadn't said it, you're right.
It's in the document. So
the idea of full is 35 million.
35 million of smoothing fund, which is basically...
How long would it take to get to there? A long time.
Depends on the markets, right? That's the hard part. And
might take years.
Well, but at the current market...
It would take years.
Yeah,
would take,
so that's what I was thinking when I read about this.
It could take 10 or more years under the current market environment. You just never know.
And one of the things you haven't addressed is that as part of this, one of the goals in investing a certain percentage, maybe 15, in equity type stuff, I think I'm used to the right word, is to generate some capital gains with that.
Mm-hmm.
And with my lack of understanding, that would not be buying stock. That would be,
it would be.
So how do you get capital gains? Tell me about capital.
No. So buy low, sell high.
What?
So
buy low, sell high.
So the way to think of it, Doug, is if you and I ran a business. And the business generated profit.
Right.
If we took the profit and reinvested in the business, we wouldn't have the money, but we would have the increase in value. The
so
value.
The way to get a capital gain is to buy a share of stock for $10
and sell it for $20.
And next year sell it for $20. And if we did that under the law, the $10 would have to go back into the principal.
That's right.
But the extra $10 can also go into the principal.
It already was principal, so
yeah.
$20 becomes principal, and that helps the fund keep up with inflation. As the fees, fines, forfeitures, and all of that diminishes.
So
the cleverness of that.
When you buy stocks, you never get any interest. You only get capital gains.
Some stocks pay dividends. So that's,
that's right,
of interest. So,
so we might get a dividend, which would have to be distributed.
Right.
But we might get a capital gains if we or SWIB is clever enough to buy and sell the right way.
Right.
Or we might have a major loss as well. Okay.
So just to wrap it up, though,
I think
overall, within the rules as we were presented with them, this, as I think Rich and Jonathan talk about, it creates a framework. I mean, this is an investment policy that creates a framework that begins to walk down the road of setting the benchmarks and the constraints on money that you might outsource or that you run internally. It starts to think about the right issues of asset allocation, the trade-off between return and risk. It moves down a path that is a natural thing to start taking advantage of with the newfound freedoms from the legislature, and I think it does it in a way that, barring a massive change in the way that the expectations about that $35 million, it does a pretty good job of moving in that direction. But it's going to be a slow grind.
Okay. Brian, just before you transfer it over, to follow up with that question, though, I think the question for the gentlemen that are also commissioners here is that if we vote for a 15% or whatever percentage to be managed, however, obviously it would be some private money manager, we're obviously taking on a risk, though. It's a big risk. So we could make zero, we could make nothing in a given year, whether the smoothing fund's there or not, because it's going to take a while. So that's something as commissioners, because we're elected and we're fiduciary.
Well, we wouldn't make nothing because we'd still have 85% earning 3.5%.
So let's say that 85 made the normal 35 million we make now. And if let's say the market lost a good chunk, we lost 30 million. That means we only made 5 million.
Well,
you wouldn't have the money to distribute.
Well, we wouldn't have the money. We wouldn't count that as a loss, even if it took a huge.
Well, it would be a loss. It would be a diminution in the size of the fund.
But not a reduction of the
we'd still have 3% of 85% of the fund.
I mean, let's say
which might, under current situations, might be $28 million instead of $35 million.
Right. And that's what argues for kind of a slow...
And our principal would take a hit. Our principal would take a hit. But yeah.
That was all built on the fact that we had to give out $35 million a year, which is what you were
doing. Exactly. And to the degree under that paradigm, I think you'd move slowly towards the 15.
Mm-hmm. 5, 10, 15, yeah.
And as the smoothing fund got created, you'd feel more comfortable getting further and further, right? Because, well, once that's in place, you start saying to yourself, well, now we have some flexibility.
And the principal hit could never be more than the 15%.
Well, that'd be in fact went to zero.
Yeah, right. Yeah, unless you kept rebalancing into stock.
Why don't you talk about the menu of some of the investments?
I mean, if we give somebody 15% and we buy a whole bunch of General Motors stock and it goes totally belly up and it now becomes worth nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the question is, what do you do the next year? Did you go back to 15%? Right. So there's the way these policies work is you have to remember that you tend to rebalance towards your target weight.
What you're saying is that our principal, the 85% could take a hit because we're forced by something to put more in there.
Yes.
But we wouldn't have to. We could say the hell with it and not put any back in there for a while. And hope that stock eventually comes back.
Yeah. Now, presumably, you wouldn't lose it all because you wouldn't put all of your money in a single name. But mechanically, we're answering your question, yeah.
My position, I think, if we were to do this, I think, would be if that happened, if we lost a lot, we would just sit on that and never put more into it and hope it would recover the way, as you point out, it almost always does, whether it's through SWIB or whether it's through MARC.
What you're saying is that if the stock market goes down, stop buying it. And I'm sort of exactly the opposite. If the stock market goes down, you want to put more money because it's going to go
back
up. The
very confidence of the bounce back would argue that you should rebalance towards it.
Or maybe put a lot more in.
Ryan, I guess it's reasonable. Yeah.
That's why I don't buy stock. I couldn't see tonight.
But you own stock in your portfolio, I'm sure, because you're a Wisconsin retiree. So
yeah.
I guess my question would be, I mean, especially for the Attorney General here, who's obviously, I'm not running again, and I don't know how many years you got left, but I feel confident it would feel better knowing if it was 10, 15, 20, 35, 50, 100% of the money being managed by SWIB. Because everybody trusts it. It's an organization.
So let me just say one thing.
I don't talk about SWIB anymore.
No, but it's to the point of what you were making.
Right.
The thing I would say about that is, I think, Matt, you're using SWIB as an example of a diversified, professionally run, you know, fund that generated pretty good returns. And that's totally fair. The truth is, if you look at their returns relative to standard benchmarks, they're slightly better, which is worth a lot when you have $100 billion. For us, I think, you know, whether it's SWIB or whether it's an index product or whether it's something else, I think all of that's on the table, and there's no reason to not look at the overall, like what fees would we have to pay and what, you know, how much better would it be. So I think the question of where that allocation to equity goes, that's an easier question in some ways than this bigger question of, I mean, the question that you raised is the biggest question is there a paradigm where we wouldn't have to worry about the librarian's expectations of that stable money? That would blow up the whole thing.
Sure.
In terms of starting over.
But for risk,
what's next?
It's a lot less if we invested individually versus somebody, you know, politically at least.
Yeah, I get that.
By the way, I took the time to trace back. I've gone back at least 70 years. The Common School Fund had been going to library books and materials for over 70 years. So
we've modified it by adding computers and other things. So.
Okay.
What are the downsides to SWIB as the diversified professionally managed fund?
That's for a future. That's if we decide to do this, and then our next meeting we have to decide.
Well, we're not voting on anything now. I guess one way or another, Doug, the money's going to get invested. The 15% is going to be invested by some entity.
That's not true.
We haven't authorized it. But if it gets, let's say we authorize 15%, somehow it's going to get invested. Either the people that work here, the investment committee, hires, you know, RFP, I don't know how they're going to do it. Somehow the money's going to be invested.
Is there a reason why we can't do it ourselves? He can buy stock.
I don't think we're going to want him buying $150 million worth of stock.
Why not?
If it doesn't go well, you're directly to blame, you're to blame, and I'm to blame.
Well, but that's our job.
Then he would be buying.
At the moment, I think I think, first of all, I don't like the stock market, so I may vote no on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But secondly, if you two vote yes, then I would be up for letting him give it a try with maybe 5%. He's done a great job on the bonds. And can you buy stocks intelligently? I presume you can.
I think I can, but I think that a more diversified portfolio would be better for our fund. I probably would recommend using a passively managed index fund for our portfolio.
Doug, because
it's a very low cost. I think that Brad asked what the downside to SWIB is, and one of those might be cost. We haven't really explored that too much. I know that if you have a passively managed index fund, it can be very low cost, and cost is an important factor here. SWIB has done a great job, but in the last year, I think that their average cost was 38 basis points every year. I know that Vanguard, and they might be able to, if we negotiate a lower rate, that'd be great. But I know that Vanguard offers institutional investors, their management expense is much lower.
8 basis points, yeah.
So there may be other options that we can explore that would be lower cost.
And still give you a diversified investment.
And Vanguard would also give us a 10 or 20 year average, which would be more than 3.5, maybe not 7.5.
I put them on our I've had them on previous documents. They've been on some of them. I put a fund.
And there's other passive managers,
but,
too.
Doug, what index fund
your
is
your
every
job
stock.
Right.
Yeah, really what I would view my job is to bring the board or the investment committee
options
to utilize that allocation.
John, okay,
we're still making those searches. Go ahead, Mike.
Do you have a burning desire to speak?
I would just say that while it's true that when you think about stocks, that there's a tendency for down years to be followed by coming back, and basically the reason for it is pretty obvious. The reason that it goes down is everyone gets scared, and as their fear dissipates, the values come back up. But it's not all that way. Some of it can be permanent. So
certain stocks.
Well, no, the whole market. There's nothing that guarantees that the whole market will hit an average over the next 20 years of anything.
And we're at an all-time high right now, correct? More or less? 17,000?
Now we're probably 8,000.
The best way to look
high.
At it is where right. Our multiples are. Our multiples are a little higher than a long-term average, but not.
Look at earnings, right? Because earnings are at all-time
right.
highs,
right?
So
yeah.
If the world is making more money,
yeah,
then of course the value of the market.
So that's probably the way we'd. Both Brian and I would, our first cut is to whether or not to think of stocks being cheap or expensive is look at where the prices are relative to earnings. And they're not that unusual right now. But there's nothing that, your point is right. Look, if there's if terrorists get a hold of nuclear weapons, you could have,
is it?
It could go down and it may not ever really come back from that.
That's the challenge with anybody. I mean, whether you're
right.
doing your own investment,
and you will face the same
7.5 is real. 5.3 is real. But the world didn't blow up in that period.
Right.
If it ever does,
well, we're in trouble.
Gets upset when I mention the word SWIB, but from a perspective of somebody like the Attorney General, myself, and yourself, we won't have been doing it ourselves.
Nobody's going to freak out by that.
This is an argument that we'll have to make when we decide what to
political
do.
Political argument.
And I've already warned you, I'm prone to vote against it because... I'm a news junkie, and I see what Argentina's collapsing, Brazil is in a mess, the Great Britain doesn't know what they're doing, the Greek economy still is not good. I mean, we could go on and on, and if all that continues to bubble, the U.S. economy may not, we've sort of been immune so far.
All right, well, let me give you the counter to that. Same story 5 years ago, right? Exactly the same story. What's happened over the last 5 years in stocks?
Taken off.
So just because, I mean, every time, go back in history and look at
it. In the streets of Chicago. I mean,
right.
There's always something to worry
right.
about.
Right, yeah. In fact, almost all, it's funny, when you look at sort of market commentary, I'm sure that if you went back over the last 50 years, every story would lead with, it's different now, risks are much higher.
but there's, that doesn't preclude that one time
it may be right.
It really would be bad. So anyway, that's enough.
Yeah, who knows? Well, that's why I don't invest in the stock market personally. Indirectly, I had no choice with my state funds.
Well, okay. You're investing in people creating businesses and, providing services. But
there's something admirable about that, too.
Well, I mean, I've been around here quite a while, as you guys know, and I'm pretty happy with loaning money to schools and municipalities and giving, you know, the idea of the principal shrinking is concerned to me, and that's why I was irritating the treasurer as to why the unclaimed property. And of course, you don't do it anymore, and now DOA does it, and I actually asked Tom a long time ago to find out why in the hell that was happening, and you gave us a report of why it happened, but I'm still a little suspicious of it.
What was the topic?
Unclaimed property.
Why DOA doesn't send us millions of dollars every year like the old treasurer used to do?
Because digitally they're able to find the owners of the unclaimed property much better than the treasurer could.
That means people are getting their money.
Fair. So we're locating the people and getting the money back to them.
Shame.
You're right. If we didn't give them any more money, if we didn't give the people their money, we'd have more money. But that's kind of counter.
That's one of the reasons, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's exactly. There's just this last, they did it 2 months ago. They gave out $13 million in just a week. They just electronically sent it out.
There is a real concern, Doug, though, that the growth in the fund isn't going to meet inflation. And that's going to make the fund worth a lot less to future generations. And that is the reason to get some capital gains to grow the fund. And so when you consider whether or not stocks are a good investment,
it boils down to, do we continue to operate as we are with the very likely, if not definitely, slowly reduction of $35 million?
Certainly in real terms.
Or do we take a gamble that we can, through capital gains investments, can we increase our current 900 and some million up to 1 billion, 1.1 billion at a rate that keeps up with,
It's already growing at about 2% a year, is about the best way to put it, between the unclaimed property and the fees, fines, and forfeitures that accrue to the state that come in.
It's still growing at 2%.
It's still growing at 2%.
But at one time it was 5% or something.
Right. And so right now, if you have $1 billion and you're getting 20 million more a year, it's growing at 2%. And so we don't have to get a huge amount of capital gains to nudge it up towards 3%.
Is that 2% enough to keep us at 35 million?
No, that would be 20 million.
Because the long-term expectation for inflation goes back to around 3%. Although none of us sitting here today know what inflation is going to be next year or the year after that. But as Matt was citing, long-term earnings of SWIB, long-term expectations of inflation tend to go back toward 3%.
The other thing that depends upon is what interest rates are. I mean, if suddenly we start loaning money to schools at 4.5%, then the whole problem goes away.
Well, higher, even.
What?
Or higher, 5%, 5.5%.
Yeah. So if one believes, and what do you two gentlemen think? We've got to turn the tape recorder off. But do you think interest rates are going to start going up? I mean, the Fed increased it by a teeny bit. In 2 or 3 years, are we going to be back at 4 or 5% for school loans? I don't know.
Well, but maybe at a 3% inflation rate, right? So...
I see. So inflation goes up from
right. Yep. So you want to break that apart into the what's it really growing in terms of what you can buy versus just the nominal dollars.
But this seems like a dumb question, but I am economically fairly dumb. Why does inflation affect what we do? I mean, we've got $1 billion. We loan it at 3.5 or maybe 4.5. And we give that money to the schools. Well, how does inflation affect us?
People can't buy as much with it.
Real simple answer. If you think about the universities.
The libraries can't buy as much.
Right.
So instead of $35 million, they're going to need $37 or $38 because of inflation. So inflation only affects that part of it. I got it. Thank you.
Purchasing power.
The libraries.
So there's a mix of investments we can make, Doug. We could be in an index of high dividend paying large cap stocks, for example. Which would give us a dividend income and a potential for capital gains. And if it went down, we'd have a paper loss, but still income from dividends. I think there's a whole menu of things that can be presented to this board and then rationally discussed to see what the appetite is for moving into these different vehicles.
And that would be the different funds that you might find,
right?
So some might be more dividend oriented. Okay.
Yeah, in fact, you know,
we'll discuss that later.
Mark and I disagreed a little bit about this, or Brian, I'm sorry, because, you know, one way to expose us to equities is to have stocks that are geared towards capital gains only. But in the current interest rate environment, it's difficult for us to take some of our money that's generating income for our beneficiaries and move it to non-income generating assets. And so what I would recommend at this stage in the current low interest rate environment is to move it into a higher dividend paying stock so that, you know, if the stock market declined, we would still get the income from those dividends. In addition to, we would not be removing a bunch of assets that don't pay any income at all, and so we'd be able to maintain our distribution with a lot higher confidence.
We wouldn't be doing anything for the quote big problem that why we're here, and that's the principal not going up.
We would be getting a little bit of that, but not as much as you would if the stocks did not pay dividends.
In the same way that moving towards 15 whatever percent you're going to clip it in stocks, doing that slowly is taking the baby steps. Using higher dividend paying stocks is even a tinier baby step.
Yeah.
Right? So Rich's point, which I think is something for the board to consider, is that if you consider this as a roadmap, a structure that you're going to answer the detailed questions of what exactly are we going to do
at a later time,
the point of today's conversation is there's a lot of flexibility that you could do within this framework, and it's really just a framework for today.
And it includes using SWIFT's resources as well.
We're all going to think about this, Mr. Chairman, and then, but do we eventually have to say we approve this framework, or it just sort of happens because it happens?
So I think there's going to need a board action.
To approve this new framework, framework, which doesn't exist. Okay, so we don't have a framework. We'd adopt one that looked like this.
Well, we've got a legislative framework that is still extant in terms of
right. But no one else. This doesn't go to the legislature on the other. This is just our decision as to how we are going to start investing money given our new legislative ability. Okay.
So as I understand, in recent years, it's been a tough time to make money because interest rates have been so low. And yet you've been bringing in record payouts to the schools year after year. What kind of things would happen that make it necessary to have this smoothing fund where we could see such a precipitous dive some year? What would make it worse than the interest rates that are making it harder for us to earn money?
Well, if we invested a lot of money in non-income producing assets, that kind of reduces our whole base that we're generating income from. And if interest rates decline, then that smaller base would be difficult to generate the current level of distributions from that. And that's where the smoothing fund would come into play, I think.
But Brad's question was sort of, in a current bad situation, interest-wise, we've been able to do very, very well. Why can't we keep on doing very, very well?
One of the benefits of doing this is because the options for our cash, we have a lot of cash.
Yeah.
And one of the options, you know, the alternative investments that we have in the bond market and in the loan program, we're pretty much fully invested where we want to be. And so this provides us an additional option in order to expand.
What you're saying is if we give you or whoever else the option to invest part of that 100 and some million, we could do even better than we're doing now.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's probably
the point.
The other thing that
the chairman was getting at is that it's been a tough interest rate environment, but where we're sitting right now is even tougher. We're talking about the 10-year Treasury bond is now at 1.36 or 1.37, which, in essence, it's touching all-time lows. And so it's not just a tough interest rate environment. We are now in the toughest interest rate environment for long-term investment.
And if schools and municipalities stop borrowing even as much as they're borrowing now, that makes it worse.
Because they're refining at lower rates. I mean, that's part of what's going on.
And we have no place to put that additional cash because it's hard for me to invest in a treasury at 1.35%.
So doing this also sort of protects the fund from low loan demand.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. It gives us additional options to invest our money to generate the income.
And right now that $100 million is earning about 0.1% or something.
It's up a little bit, but it is very low. And we would like to earn more.
It's less than a percent, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the worst you would do in the stock market, unless the world goes to hell, like Mark said.
Well, the S&P 500, the dividend yield from the S&P 500, which is the interest rate basically that the stock market is throwing off, is currently over 2%, somewhere in the 2.25% range. And so if we just went into an index fund for the S&P 500, that $100 million would earn 2.25% dividend yield in addition to some exposure for capital gains. And I think that that's a better place for us to be, not that that's the fund that I'm recommending, but that's a better place for us overall to be than having all of that money in cash.
One last question, which is not relevant now, and if you brought it up, I'd make you be quiet, because what is SWIB's ratio of dividend versus capital gains?
Good question.
Probably pretty similar. It's probably similar to that, but it would depend exactly on how they're running it. I would think it's probably, they're value oriented, so it's probably at least at five.
For their stock part.
Yeah, for the
stock
part.
And then, they have other investments too, which would have different interest rate characteristics.
You assume SWIB leans towards dividends rather than capital gains.
I think on average that's true. I don't know what they're doing.
Possibly.
Right now. Possibly.
I mean, yeah. So it's not, I wouldn't guess it's above 2.5.
No. It's probably very close.
Very
to that.
Close. Just a little higher than
that. We'll have to find out. I mean, that would be one question we needed before we followed your inclination. Okay.
Well, Mark had a point earlier that I've never fully got an answer, and it would really make a difference in regards to the trust fund loan program and being an advantageous because we're a loan originator and we can capture school aid. And I've been told it's definitely in law that we can sell them. I've asked Donna Hunter, we've talked about this, but I don't understand who would be the person that would buy these. Does anybody want to buy these, and could we sell them? Because that would free up a lot of opportunities, because if we ever did need to liquidate to free up money for either other loans or something else, it would give us the money. But I've never understood that anybody, they're not the same as bonds, where they're trading on the same market.
The opportunity that we would have is to package those loans into a security. Let's say that we wanted to create a $20 million security for another institution to buy. Let's say Northwestern Mutual or some other large institutional investor would buy that package of loans from us. And we would generate a capital gain on that sale.
Right, but
presumably
you would still have to be involved because the reason the loans are so valuable is you have the ability to...
No, that's right.
We have all the administration, and then you'd have
to... If we sold those loans, the buyer would not have that power anymore?
No, we would retain servicing. And so our customers wouldn't know that actually happened.
Yeah, so we would still have the power.
Am I right in theory we could almost never actually own any of the loans ourselves then? We could constantly just...
We could sell them as... Yes.
Okay, I would like to personally get going. I don't want to leave.
I just had one other thing to quickly talk about, only because I've talked about it on the side, and I'm going to talk with the governor's office about it, and I'll take maybe 2 seconds. I don't know if you're familiar, but one of the other things I've talked to Jonathan about, because I want to give him a heads up, is one of the other things, the loans, one of the things we're looking at is a problematic in that any equity, any stock market's going to have risk, and that's what it is. What we've been doing is fixed income, BPL loans, all that stuff. And obviously we make money. We're not going to lose money. It's a fixed loan. We have the protections to go after school aid. There was only one other thing that I've been talking with some of the members in the legislature as well as other people in the building is that possibly looking at an opportunity where the BCBL could be involved in real estate, not through REITs necessarily, but in the state of Wisconsin, only through a state agencies where we'd own the building. And I'll just give a quick example, but if you want to know more about it, because I'm not going to have a lot of time here, I did do a WSI interview for 30 minutes on it with Stephen Walters. But basically, to give an example, there's many projects that come up that we don't have the financing for. And the Attorney General, I'm sure, knows about one. There's a Milwaukee crime lab that they've been trying to build for a bunch of years. And what ends up happening is we don't have the money because the legislature is being, fiscal hawks. They don't want to put out any more bonding for it. So then these projects either don't get done or get delayed and delayed. And we have cash. Obviously, we have any given day, we have $150 million, $100 million. We have $40 million at that FDIC account. So, for example, there was a building that was done 10 years ago. It's called the Femrite Data Center. None of you are going to know what that is because I know Jonathan does because him and I've talked about it. But basically what happened 10 years ago is what's going to happen to some of these same facilities like the DOJ Crime Lab. Well, we don't actually build them at the state. We work with a developer to build them, and then the developer owns them. So it's a state agency that we have the whole building.
We lease it.
We lease it from them for skyrocket rent. So, for example, the Femrite Data Center, which is on the east side of Madison.
We do that because we don't have the capital to build them to start with.
Correct, correct. So Femrite building got built for $25 million. It was $23 million to build 10 years ago. We rented it for the 10 years we've been there, and then we just bought it. So the building commission finally authorized it. When it was built, it cost $23 million. In the 10 years, the state of Wisconsin's paid $25 million in rent on it. So it cost $23, paid $25 a rent.
Now we bought it for?
We just bought it for $22.5. We sold it. We bought it for $22.5. So basically, it's the same amount of money. It didn't even really depreciate.
But we didn't make a capital gain then. No capital gain on that.
Well, we didn't because we didn't own it. But the developer made $25 million on it.
They did? I thought you said it bought and sold at the same price.
But we paid $25 million in rent.
In rent, yeah. He didn't make a capital gain. He only made interest rate.
I'm sorry. It would be short-term rental income, which counts as interest rate.
I thought you were saying a way to make capital gains.
I might have used the words wrong. I apologize. But basically what the state did in the column I just gave there, and you can go through this at your leisure, but it's called the rent, and then I have one for you guys. But rent and buy, for the first 10 years, the state paid $25 million in rent. And then now we're buying it for $32 million. That's with interest. So it's a 22.5 plus interest. So the state, the second column is exactly what happened. The state spent $58 million for this building. Okay, that's what it's going to cost us with interest plus the 10 years of rent. If the BCPL, and again, we didn't have this authority, if it didn't exist, 10 years ago, if we had just bought it for $23 million, the BCPL would have made all that rental income, the $25 million, and we would continue to rent it. So to compare that to, let's say, the crime lab that's coming up or other facilities, the state doesn't have the money to buy these facilities, so we have to broker a deal with these developers, and then the developer reaps all the income.
Yeah, well, I guess your point, what you're saying is we should look at the option of buying a building.
Only for state facilities. We're not buying
them. And collecting rent.
Correct.
Can we get the same outrageous rent that the developers get?
Well, I don't know why we couldn't because, well, first of all, that's obviously the market rate, but more importantly, anything the state gives us, so let's say they gave that exact same place, the legislature isn't going to have a problem authorizing that because we, when we make our money, we're giving it back in distributions on a yearly basis to every single school district. So anywhere in the state's going to love it.
Well, I get the idea. Sure. Again, just to be clear, in my mind, they probably get it. This would be a way to increase our revenue,
yes,
but not our principal. There are no capital gains involved here.
Not necessarily. You would do like you do at any rental property. You would have to do a depreciation schedule, maybe 10 years or 20 years. You depreciate the building, so the money would go back into the principal, but you would be making the money on the rental.
Who's going to manage it? Who will manage the
car? Good question. It's very similar to what SWIB does next door to us.
Air conditioners only go out when it's 93 degrees.
SWIB's building next door to us is
that's the chairman's job.
Yeah, well, SWIB's building next door to us is very similar. They own the building, but they manage it with a private, you know, developer or property management company. We wouldn't be doing that. We would hire, you know, as an RFP, a property management company, whether it's in Milwaukee or Madison. I'll just give you an example.
So the $25 million in rent is going to be offset by a lot of costs. So what?
Well, to give you an example, there's no cost. Because in this instance, the state gives such bad deals. That $25 million was all cash. There was no maintenance. The state provided all maintenance, down to cutting the lawn. That's what the developer got, was nothing. He literally just got checks. They didn't do anything. We changed the light bulbs and everything. The state had that package. When we do these buildings in the... If we did a crime lab, it might be similar to that because it's a full functioning facility where the state doesn't do it. And it, you know, the crime lab has been, you know, could cost up to $60 million. They don't know. But these are facilities that we don't have the funds for, but we do. And again, we're not discussing anything, you know, voting on anything today. It's just something to think about, and I'll give you more information as we go along. But, you know, I'll give you, just as a, I got another folder for the DOJ here.
Is there a bill that's been drafted to authorize?
No, but I've talked with a legislator that would do it. We're not at the point to do it because obviously they're out of session right now.
Okay, well, the question I would have, and we don't have time for it, but let's just break quick, would be what do these five people think about the idea?
Can I let them, after I just do one more thing, and then I'll let them talk about it? Just to give you what I just gave you there, to give an example, the state has facilities all throughout Wisconsin. This isn't as pertinent for you two gentlemen, but for example, another building we have is the DOJ Crime Lab in Wausau. the state pays in rent yearly there almost $400,000, $382,000. The building is worth $900,000. So almost in 2 years we pay for the building. So for example, the DOJ would be still be a tenant, but they'd be a tenant to the BCPL. And that's just one agency. I picked that because obviously you're in charge of that agency.
Are there many examples of this?
Any examples.
That already happened. Are there any that are future that we can get involved in?
Future would be buildings that are on the horizon through the building commission that have been stalled. Right now what's happening at the building commission is because there isn't a motivation to build buildings because we have to bond for it, they're all stalled. I mean, some get through, but generally it's stalled.
But there are a few around that
correct.
We can buy.
Okay.
Matt, how do we get a $900,000 value in the building? Like if you or I were going up there to look at that and they showed me a contract for $380,000 a year in rent, we would pay a lot more than $900,000.
Well, good question, because that's based on the rental portion of it. But the state, that's the value. If our lease expired, then there wouldn't be a tenant. We rent the whole building. So I'll give you the most egregious example. I've done this. I was my WSI interview was Department of Corrections is over on the east side. We all drive past, and when we call them up, you obviously live up here, so you don't. That building is the most egregious. I talked to Neitzel, who is our DOA secretary, told us it's a terrible deal. That building is worth anywhere around $10 million. We pay $5 million a year in rent.
And when you say worth $10 million,
that's the value.
If the state walked away and they had to scrap to try to refill it,
it would be worth less than that because nobody wants it. It's huge. We are the state of Wisconsin is the only people that can fill these buildings up. It's a 260, it's the old AmSam HQ, which nobody needs.
You say it's worth $5 million. How much did it cost to originally build it?
That it was built in the 60s, so that's not relevant. It's worth 10. When I use the word
it's
10.
It's a very old building, right. So it's depreciated down to almost nothing.
Exactly, but it's worth the $10 million based on the city assessment, and I actually think it's worth less because we could get it. But use a simple math. If we bought it for 10, because we have plenty of money in the BCPL, we'd lend more than that on a weekly basis. If we bought it for 10 and they gave us $5 million in rent, that's 50%.
So you're suggesting that we buy existing old buildings?
Only if it's a state facility that's 100%.
Yeah.
It could make sense on a case-by-case basis. But it's just something to think about. I'm not pushing anything specific to that.
So the developer makes the money. They have a 10-year contract to lease it, and they know exactly what their income's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, Doug,
so they're likely not to sell it.
You're right. They won't sell it now.
It would be an aggressive negotiation because to get the good price, you'd have to be willing as a state to threaten, well, if you don't give it to us, we're going to walk away. But that would mean that you'd need
another facility,
and then you'd have to figure so it'd be a complicated.
Sure.
They can have that put together overnight, as I've learned from the Cramlin.
No,
fiasco.
No, they don't. Oh, I know what you're saying.
I mean, there can.
Yeah, I know exactly. But I mean, give you an example. If the Cramlin gets built in the Milwaukee area, that's the big problem. They got a crummy one on the south side of Milwaukee. It's too small. They're not going to authorize the spending for it. This is not seemingly happening. So what they're going to do is they're going to go to a developer. Well, instead of going to a private developer who would be doing this to make money, they're not doing it to lose money. And we would have an advantage because we could be tax-exempt, unlike the developer. So, I own rental properties. One of the biggest expenses in owning a property is your property taxes.
And this crime has not been built yet?
No. There are a lot of buildings.
If we were to buy it, we have to build it then.
We would build it.
We'd have to hire a carpenter and a bricklayer.
Well, one construction company would bid it, just like DOA does
right now.
And they would bid it to the facts of the agency. That's how they do it. It's just something to think about.
It might be kind of fun. I kind of like this idea.
The bill would exempt us from all PILT as well, then?
No, PILT is small, though. It would be PILT is... Like, for example, in the Femite building, taxes at the Femite building went from $450,000 a year to $27,000. So we do PILT, which is services and payments in lieu of taxes for police and fire, basically.
No, what I'm saying is now, when we acquire property, we make payments in lieu of taxes...
Based on the current value.
No, based upon what the previous owner paid.
Yeah, current value, yeah. Current value of the build, which would be land at that point, correct?
For a building that exists today, for a private developer that owns it, if we were going to buy it, we would pay till equal to what that...
We're going to change that. I've talked a lot. They would just change it to be normal PILT, not the previous. Because the reason that was done was for... the properties in northern Wisconsin, because the legislative members up there didn't want land coming off the tax rolls in northern Wisconsin and them paying nothing. This is completely different because it'd be property in basically Milwaukee and Madison.
Does that require a slight change?
This would all require some language for the legislature.
That wouldn't be a problem, you don't think, for talking to folks.
Excuse me? No. Well, I wouldn't.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, I kind of oppose a lot of stuff. a good
thing. Well, look, think about it. I mean, where you had your office.
But let me say that this sounds kind of appealing. I mean, unless you five guys and say why that's a horrible idea, for us to buy this, to go to the building commission and say, okay, we'll buy this crime lab. Or we'll build this crime lab for you. And then we get a contractor, we build it. It costs $50 million to build it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would get rent from the state. Mm-hmm. The state would then pay us hundreds of million dollars a year in rent. The state might want to negotiate tough with us. But
they're negotiating with themselves because every penny we make goes back to every single school district. So the legislature, when we say the state, it would be the legislature and the governor. They're not going to want to, you know, rip us off because if they did, they'd be hurting.
And it would be up to the crime lab people to maintain that building. We wouldn't be stuck.
We would most likely hire. We would do just like SWIB does. We would hire a property management company to hire, which is through.
But if you use it under the current system, the state has to take on responsibility.
That was under the Famright building. That was one specific building.
We couldn't get the same deal here?
Probably.
I mean, I like the idea of the tenant having to be the responsibility, not us, for the maintenance of the building.
And again, this is in the early stages. I don't know anything. They don't even have the RFP out public, so we don't know where we're at. But just something to think about. And it's only because I'm talking about it in the public sphere, I thought I should share it at least with the commissioners so they knew it was something I was at least talking about.
You are a wild guy. Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, anything else on this this agenda item? Okay, well, thank you, Mark and Brian, very much.
Thank you.
Any future agenda items anyone wants to talk about right now? Okay, is there an executive secretary report today? Okay, then I'll look for a motion to adjourn.
I'll make it.
Second. Done.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. Thank you, everyone. We can't talk now.